Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Tiger Bales and Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, Amy, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good to see you back in the studio today.
It's good to be here. I mean, we're winding down to our last five shows, your last today, and I'm hoping to carry on next week, seeing you've been carrying it for the last 5 weeks in my absence. So well done. Thank you.
No,
been great.
Thanks. It's good to be back. It's good to have you back, though. But especially because we've got a really special guest in the studio
today. Well, that's why I come
today.
In here. I heard so much about this bloke, and I thought, I've got to meet this young black fella, this young black man. Yeah.
So we got a caller in the studio today. You're a rapper, social commentator, writer. But do you want to tell us a bit about your background and your history?
Yeah. Who's your mob? Where are you from?
Well, I was born and brought up in London, but my dad is from Jamaica. And my mum is from a group of islands just off the coast of Scotland called the Outer Hebrides, called Benbecula. So I was brought up in London in a very mixed neighbourhood with a lot of people, immigrants from the Caribbean, from Cyprus and Ireland. So North London, kind of working class community, but very mixed. London is very mixed. And I had a very theatrical, cultural, even though it was economically poor, you know, I had a very culturally rich upbringing. My stepdad was the stage manager of London's leading black theatre in the 80s. My real dad was a sound system DJ, you know. So I kind of had a really unique, I think, upbringing and a very London upbringing. But culturally was exposed to a lot of stuff that I think has informed what I've gone on to try and do.
And when did you start to look at rap as a medium to start to look at a lot of these ideas and a lot of what you wanted to express?
Well, actually, always. The way I came into rap was through rappers that were doing that. So my earliest memories of hip-hop were Public Enemy. My dad used to play just play Public Enemy day in, day out. And I knew all the words to Fear of a Black Planet when I was like 7, right? And then as I came to discover my own hip-hop, because, you know, I was like 7 when that album came out. When I started listening to hip-hop for myself, it was in the early 90s. There was a lot of the street stuff, which is cool. But there was also the Wu-Tang, Gravediggers, Common, Mos Def. There was a real era of consciousness in hip-hop. And so I always thought that's what part of what rappers should do. The first person I ever saw give a lecture was KRS-One. And so I always saw rap as a means for social commentary.
Yeah, right.
If that makes sense. There was never a point where I thought, oh, this would be a good thing to use to do that. I always saw that as part of the rapper's task.
And you talk a lot about racism, but in a very different way. I think we have a very limited discourse around the idea of racism, particularly in Australia. But you talk about the importance of history, don't you? When did you start to get into understanding that history informs so much of the everyday racism currently in existence today?
Well, again, I was very lucky. So in the 70s in the UK, a lot of the Caribbean community that immigrated to Britain in the post-war years, they had their first generation of British-born children. And what started to happen was the British state openly adopted racist policies aimed at disenfranchising that generation of black children. One was called ESN, which was educationally subnormal, which they would declare black children educationally subnormal and basically, you know, unable to be taught and put them in special needs groups. Another was called the SUS laws, where you could be arrested on suspicion of committing a crime. So you haven't done anything. Yep. I've arrested and charged you because I suspect you.
These are growing up in the 70s.
So a lot of my dad's generation were treated pretty badly in school and were criminalized by the state for openly racist reasons. Now everyone looks back and says, yeah, that was pretty racist. At the time, of course, no one admitted that it was aimed at doing that to the black community, which is always the case. People, it was racist back then, but why can't you just get over it today?
Yeah.
Now, what happened in the 70s was that black communities' response to that was to set up their own Saturday schools, their own educational provisions, where they taught black history, where they'd help kids with maths, where they'd help kids with their science. I went to one of these called the Winnie Mandela School. And so very early, I started to learn that what I was being taught in school, particularly with regards to black people, with regards to history in general, didn't tally up with the reality.
Yep.
So they used to teach us in school, you know, slavery is bad, but an English man called William Wilberforce set black people free. And I learned about
always
the Maroon.
Always framed in the white man as the saviour, exactly. Isn't it?
And the thing is, there were white abolitionists in Britain, and those people should be remembered because they campaigned. But the pretending that they saved black people was really arrogant and silly, especially given that in the Caribbean, we were busy burning down plantations, killing slave masters, revolting, the only successful slave revolution in human history where the enslaved people of a society overturned the government and became the government themselves occurred in Haiti, right before all of a sudden Europe abolished slavery. Isn't that a strange coincidence? And so learning this history very early made me realise history had been weaponized. And the way in which Africa was presented as this kind of savage, backwards, tribal warfare, cannibalistic place when I was growing up was a way of justifying how Africa is today. So it was a way of saying, well, it was always bad and Europeans came along and maybe made it a little bit worse, but it was always bad anyway, so I don't feel bad about it. And obviously, I'm not saying it was perfect before white people showed up. Of course it wasn't. But the point is, there were very developed civilizations. There was a range of ways of living. And even the idea that if Africans were living, quote-unquote, a more simple life, that would have justified committing genocide on them is a rather odd way to view humans anyway. There were people living in Britain who were farmers or hunter-gatherers or whatever else until very recently. Does that mean we should kill those people? Yeah, I mean, even the idea that having less technology somehow makes you less human is very, very strange anyway. But a lot of the range of types of living that had occurred in Africa were deliberately distorted. And that was particularly the case with ancient Egypt, where there was a massive effort, and it's still going on, to pretend that the ancient Egypt...
You see the whitewashing in pop culture of Egypt and what it actually was. Because you know the history of it, but it's a suppressed history, and it's a really controversial history when it really shouldn't be.
Exactly. That's the key point. When it shouldn't be, it's not controversial. Scores of ancient Greeks who Western history considers to be, you know, clever people, Aristotle, Herodotus, etc., saw the ancient Egyptians for their own eyes and were very clear about the colour of the people they saw. Could they have been so stupid that they couldn't recognise a black person from a non-black person? Yeah. And they were very clear, all of them. It's not like a few of them said they were olive-skinned and a few said they were black and there was confusion. They were like, these are black people. The word they use is Ethiops or Melandros, which are some of the strongest words in Greek to denote black. So it isn't controversial. You look at the statues, all of that. But the why it's controversial is because the very idea of whiteness and of race is predicated on the idea that white people are superior and other groups of people are inferior, and particularly black people are at the bottom.
Yeah.
So Aborigines from here and people, the indigenous people of Africa and Native Americans, but it was that the idea was that blacks are at the very bottom. So obviously evidence of a black civilization thousands of years ago, before there was anything comparable in Europe, violates all of that. And again, I'm not saying that just because people built, you know, pyramids or carved granite, that makes them superior human beings. That's a European way of viewing history. Oh, they built big buildings, therefore they're civilized. They might not have all been nice. Do you know what I mean? So it's a very odd way to weigh human value. The point is, in the European scheme of weighing human value, ancient Egypt contradicted all of that. And so for me, I've realized that reteaching history, you don't need to romanticize it, but just teaching the facts of resistance. Even here, I know people were in school, Aboriginal kids were taught, oh, you know, you didn't put up a fight. You just kind of, you know, you just let us have the land, basically, which is obviously a way of disempowering you. And then all the real information about the frontier war starts to come up, and you realize, actually, we fought you tooth and nail every step of the way.
And still fighting.
Precisely.
But this is why it's so important to champion black achievement as well, because we had that. We've had Bill Gamage on, and I think we're talking a bit about this, a book called The Greatest Estate on Earth, where he talks about the really complicated system of land management all across the country, but how that was wiped out by Australian history and these lies that we were hunter and gatherers and we were
trying
basically
to diminish our
nothing.
or reduce our humanity.
Of course.
Write us out of existence,
of course,
out of history altogether, you know.
Of course, out of intelligence.
Yes,
and the irony
we were
is,
the first people in the world, on the planet, the first people to be for stone structures, for houses, agriculture, crops, a whole range of things. We are the oldest people on the planet, and we're the first people. We're the first people that use the stars for travel, all of these sorts of things.
That we're only starting to find out now.
Yes, yeah.
But there's probably so much more to uncover and so much more to
learn. Well, there is. There's massive.
It's kind of sad in a way because you shouldn't even have to say, draw up past achievements to say we're human. We're human. That's the end of it. Even if you arrive in a country and people are hunter and gatherers, how does that justify murdering them still? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a weird thing where you're caught up between saying, but we were civilized, therefore it wasn't okay to kill us. But actually, it wouldn't have been okay to kill us regardless.
That's right.
Murder is still murder. There are people on the earth today. The reason why I say that is because there are people on the earth today in the Andaman Islands or in Brazil or other places in the Amazon that are do live more quote-unquote simply, that are hunter and gatherers, that are not living a sedentary kind of city or town-based life. Are we saying that those people should be murdered? Of course not.
Yeah.
That's wonderful that they've managed to live in equilibrium with the environment. Maybe we could learn a thing or two from that. And so it's a really, history is a really, really important part. And obviously Western culture knows this. That's why they've lied about so much history.
Yeah.
That's why they've pretended that Europeans invented everything. Anything the ancient Greeks didn't invent, the Renaissance or the Enlightenment invented, you know, completely ignoring the fact that Spain was an Arab and African country for 800 years, ignoring the fact that the number system that the whole world counts with today comes from India, ignoring so many different parts of history. Copernicus definitely copied a guy from Persia, but he's now given all the credit from that because the book of, I believe that guy's name is Ibn Shatta, but don't quote me on that. But that guy's book was in the Vatican Library. Copernicus copied it, then gets credited with discovering that the Earth was round and that the Earth was not at the center of the solar system and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, right.
So there's been a lot of exchange.
You never hear about this
fella. No, of course. No. But there's been a lot of exchange of information between cultures. And none of that is to say Europe has not been intelligent or white people are not intelligent. It's weird that people feel that almost like white achievement is less if other groups of people have achievement too.
Yeah, they just have to feel superior.
That's really weird racism where it's like, oh, if Indians and Africans and Aborigines are clever too, then we don't really feel as clever. I don't feel less clever because Chinese people are clever. Like, I've studied some Chinese history. They were the most advanced nation on the earth for probably most of the last 2,000 years. I don't feel that that makes black people less human. That's where China's been at for a couple thousand years. Great. Interesting. So I've always tried to teach history in ways that are creative and interesting as well and innovative, but definitely using history to inform present political action. Look what worked. Look what didn't work. One of my favorite scholars says history is a clock that people use to tell their cultural, political, and social time of day. It's a map that humans use to locate themselves on the scale of human geography, Dr. John Henrik Clark. And I really like that. It's not just about navel gazing and say, you know, our ancestors built great stuff. Hey, we can just say we're great.
Yep.
It's about saying, you know, what can we learn from the past? What wasn't so good? And how can we move forward?
You've talked also about sort of this uniformity of sort of what's happening to oppressed peoples all across the country, all across the world, as a symptom or consequence of colonialism, haven't you? Coming from the UK, now that you're in Australia, can you see that uniformity here?
Yeah, I mean, I knew a little bit. I know I'd watched a few documentaries and I understood a little bit of the history. I wasn't an expert by any means, but, you know, I knew that genocide had occurred here. So I knew the situation in many ways is more extreme than in the UK. Similarities, definitely. Forms of cross-pollination in the way that the system of racism and classism operate, in the way that even poor people are encouraged to hate and fight among one another when they probably have common interests because, you know, especially poor whites are, you know, sort of dangled this carrot. Well, at least you're not an Aborigine.
Yeah.
You know, at least you're white. You know, have some pride in that as if, you know, that improves their material situation. We have a similar system of that in the UK. So I do see similarities, but I also see differences. And I think it's also important to respect the differences. Like in the UK, a lot of people are like, oh, it's like America. Well, yeah, it is, but no, it's not really. I mean, the police in Britain do kill people, no doubt about it, but they're not shooting 12-year-olds dead in the street on camera for everyone to see and getting away with it. That doesn't make it okay that people die in police custody in Britain, but the extremity of the situation in America is a lot more extreme. Just like the extremity of the situation in Brazil is even more extreme, or South Africa. And I think here is sort of somewhere in between where it seems there does seem to me to be a resurgence of kind of Aboriginal self-confidence. And a mix with the new African, Arab, other immigrant communities. But maybe this is just because I was part of panels this week and among political activist groups. It does seem that there's a sense, but that could just be my skewed vision because I'm in political circles. I'm sure that mainstream Australia is perfectly happy with the way things are and doesn't really care two shits about whether or not, pardon my language.
Maintain the status quo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Is exactly
it's like,
the
why can't you just
that?
Get over it? Which is
exactly.
History is something to be learned from, not got over. I do find it funny when people say that, though, because I teach Shakespeare as well. And not once in all the thousands of workshops I've done about Shakespeare has anyone ever said, why can't you just get over Shakespeare?
No.
It was in the past. So it's very fascinating.
I just wonder, because in Australia, we do have this real historical amnesia. And you were talking a bit, it's similar to Britain, but it just seems so much more insidious here, because they don't, when you talk about working class whites, they don't even want to learn about their convict history and the really horrendous stuff that happened there. But when you talk about frontier wars, it's completely off the table. It's this amazing controversial subject. I mean, that historical amnesia, is it the same in Britain, or do you see it as worse over here?
It seems worse here. one of the reasons is, I mean, in London, for example, white English people are now the minority. In the last census, this became a fact. The majority of people in London are no longer what consider themselves white British. So you've got whites from Eastern Europe, but most of the people in London, half of them are from Britain's former colonies. India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Jamaica.
I think this country's got a similar situation where white people are the minority.
I'm not sure.
Maybe it's changing. I don't know. But they're not the minority in the country in the UK, but they are becoming the minority in London. Now, what this has led to is, of course, you can't avoid having relationships with people from Pakistan or India or Jamaica or elsewhere.
Yeah.
And so even if you want to maintain your ignorance, there is a certain level of understanding of different stories. Multiculturalism, our government keeps saying multiculturalism hasn't worked, but in many ways it kind of has. And if you look at where UKIP and the other openly like far right-wing parties, even the Tories, get votes, it's in all the places where there are no immigrants.
Yeah.
So in London, Birmingham, Manchester, Bristol, Liverpool, they've not got
people
backing.
Who have no contact with
right.
immigrants.
So the most racist people are the people who don't know any of the people they're being racist to, which is fascinatingly ignorant, right? Because you don't actually know these people. But so there is historical amnesia in Britain, but I wouldn't say it's quite the same. Yeah. For example, there was a programme very recently on mainstream TV. I'd love to tell you, oh, it's just as bad, but I would be being fake. There was a programme called Britain's Forgotten Slave Masters. And it was on BBC Two, mainstream TV, 9 o'clock at night. I know the guy who made it. And it was basically about the when slavery was abolished in Britain, the slave masters, not the enslaved, got £20 million compensation for their loss of property from the British government. Largest payout till the bankers bailout in 2008. £16 billion in today's money. And what the programme exposed blatantly was that actually it wasn't what we'd thought. It wasn't just a small elite class of British people that owned Africans. Lots of middle-class people owned one slave here, two there, blah, blah, blah. Mm. You know, and actually 40% of the slave owners at that time were women, which was really fascinating to people.
Wow.
Because they had inherited their enslaved people from their husband or their father. And, of course, they didn't suddenly, in a moment of, you know, feminist solidarity, say, I don't want to own any black people.
Yeah.
Because they were, as far as they were concerned, black people weren't human. That's why they continued to own them. So there is a degree... Not as to the degree I'd like. There is a degree of addressing of Britain's colonial history, though there is most of the mainstream. It's like 90% of the time, we're like, the British Empire was great.
Yeah.
Everything was wonderful. Don't criticise the country. But there is this 10% space, whereas it seems like the space here is maybe 2%.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Britain and its history, historical amnesia around colonialism, because the other stuff you talk about is they almost outsource it. It happened over there, so we don't want to think about it because it happened in other countries. Obviously, it didn't happen on British soil.
Yeah, well...
It happened in Australia, for example.
It did happen in Britain, but it happened mostly to poor whites, and they don't want to talk about it.
Right.
You know, until very recently, you know, mid-19th century, they were still hanging poor people for stealing bread or rich people's hats at a place called Tyburn.
Convicts ended up in Australia for that reason.
But it wasn't even just convicts. This is the other thing. A lot of the people sent to Australia were political dissidents.
Yeah, right.
And it's ironic.
Political dissidents, but also orphans, children that were taken off their parents and sent out here.
Exactly.
I mean, there's a lot of those
kind
here
of brutality.
This is the way they treated their own people in their own country back in those days.
Exactly.
How can we expect anything different to be treated as a First Nations, as a sovereign people?
Yeah.
Mm. This society is so new, so young, so immature, 230-odd years old.
Mm.
You look at the Americas. What are they, 520 or something since Columbus and stuff like this? So we're a very young country and very, very immature.
Yeah.
And we're still trying to teach them. We are still trying to teach them.
Good luck.
They're slow learners. We'll get there. We'll get there.
But no, I like to think that the world is evolving towards something better. But there's also every reason to believe maybe it isn't, and to not get complacent and say, you know what, we're in a pretty bad space, and if humans don't change our conduct, really maybe within the next century there might not be any humans left to change conduct. And that's not unrealistic, you know.
No, there's a big chance of that.
Yeah, World War III is not impossible, you know. Mm-hmm. Complete natural disasters and climate change, all of that is a big possibility. And we're not that important in the scheme of the universe, you know.
I think we're the greatest parasite to happen to the Earth, actually, when you consider overpopulation and climate change. And
But I see the overpopulation I don't agree with. I think overpopulation is a myth, but we are overpopulated at the rate that we consume,
if that makes
sense.
Yeah.
But actually, I mean, Australia could house every person on the Earth comfortably. Africa, if farmed correctly, could feed the world's population like six times over.
Mm. Yep.
So there is enough food, there is abundance, but we don't share. Europe throws away more food, enough food to feed the whole world many times over every year. right? So it's the allocation of resources and the lack of sharing of the resources, the monopolization of resources by some economies and some companies that makes it seem like the world is overpopulated. But actually, if you look at the places that economically develop, they've got big populations. You know, that's how cities are formed.
Yeah.
So one of the ways they've kept Africa underdeveloped is by, oh, there's too many of you, it's overpopulated. It needs to be sparse. But you go to places in Africa, a country like Congo,
yeah.
and I don't know what the population of the Congo is, but I'm pretty sure it's around the same as the population of Britain. And Congo is the size of Western Europe. It's like, it's completely underpopulated. It needs more people. But maybe some people believe that it needs more non-African people.
Yeah, a bit like Australia. They want more...
More people who are not Aborigines.
More non-coloured people coming into the place, you know. Amy, we might take a break for a song. Our guest is a young man from the UK, from London, more precisely.
Yes.
Akala, a young rapper and very articulate with history and the situation in his country. And we hope that he takes home with him a better understanding of just what this country's doing or how our people, First Nations people here, sovereign people of this country are treated. So here's a song, one of my favourites. Could be a bit of a rap, I don't know. Got a good message. It's Titters with Anthem.
Don't sing me an anthem, because you don't know the words.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. My co-host here, Amy McGuire, and our guest, Akala. Young man from London, a young rapper, but he also works with history, teaching history and in education over there. And it's great to have him out here. You've got a gig on tonight. You're performing.
I am indeed, yes. I'm primarily a hip-hop artist and writer. And tonight I'm doing a gig supported by two local Australian artists, Jim Blar and Omar Musa, at the Woolly Mammoth in Brisbane.
Jim Blar is a black fella too, down from
First
Victoria.
Nations man.
Yeah. And we're doing a show tomorrow in Sydney as well at the Newtown Social. So, you know, Melbourne sold out. Melbourne was cool. So.
What's been your impression of this country? You've been Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane?
I came 3 years ago as well.
Did you?
Yeah. Well, I think the problem is when you're a person like me, when you're a political person, we have certain beliefs, usually the people that invite you to their country share the same sort of beliefs. So you have almost like this cocooned experience where I've basically been on these panels about race and class and politics and around really well-read, educated, progressive-minded people. So it almost gives you a skewed appearance of the country. Obviously, I'm smart enough to know mainstream Australia is not really like that.
Yeah.
But I can't say I've experienced the bigotry and the ignorance that people say is so much a part of this society because I'm cocooned around all these really cool people. Like, if you came to London and you just hung out with me and my friends, you'd think London was a Pan-Africanist paradise. You'd be like, wow, all these, you know, political young black people, you know, exchange. I'd take you to certain events and you'd be like, wow. But then if you lived in London a bit more, you start to see the cracks. And so I feel a little bit like my experience of Australia is a bit fake because I've been surrounded by cool people.
Well, you can't get too broad an experience in the time that you're here because you're doing
10 days. Yeah, exactly.
You've got a lot of things to do. You can't get too broad an experience and get a good insight into things.
But it brings up that focus as well, which I think you've talked about before. I mean, and we have that problem in Australia where every month almost we've got a racist controversy, but it revolves around like a racist incident on the bus or something stupid. Someone in the media has said, like Eddie McGuire or Pauline Hanson, and they said something so outrageously racist. But we never talk about the structural racism that white people can't see. And some black fellows can't see,
I think people can see. I think people choose not to see what benefits them.
It's not in their interest to see.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's undermining their whole belief system.
But it also undermines your position to be told that maybe you are where you are partly because of class, race, gender privilege.
Yeah.
It's problematic. You know, there's less women in science, not because women are less intelligent, because from the day you're born as a woman, science is not marketed to you as something that women do.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
So you have less women there's more women in science in Iran and India as a percentage than there is in the UK. And we're always saying how sexist those countries are. Of course, I'm not saying sexism is not a problem there. I'm just saying that was fascinating to me when I found that out. Similarly, I live in London, where over 50% of the people are black and brown. Yeah, if I walk into any major institution, arts, banks, any major institution in London, it doesn't look anything like this. Politics, the city it's supposed to represent.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen by accident. So there's a quota system in place that white Britain doesn't even want to admit is in place because then it has to look at itself. So much so we actually do have drives to get diversity. This is how normal racism is in the UK and we don't realise it. we have these drives where we have to say, all right, let's at least interview more black and brown people. Mm. Let's actually do outreach, because our natural inclination is just to go and employ loads more middle-class white people.
So you're saying with your promotions, your publicity, the media promoting product, it's white faces?
No, what I mean is it's a bit more diverse.
So
Britain also, it's about class. So Britain has an inherited aristocracy that still run the country. They've been running the country for 1,000 years. I mean, almost all of our government went to the same school. So even if you're a rich white guy, if you didn't go to the right school, you're not going to be in senior government. Yeah. All the senior heads of media, and I mean like 85%, I'm not talking about a small amount,
really,
went to the same school, Eton, and then they go to Oxford or Cambridge.
Wow.
Right? So it's a real old boys network. Yeah. So you have that as a normalised part of this supposedly democratic society where the country is run by people who went to the same school. In our parliament, we have a thing called the House of Lords, which is an unelected second chamber that exerts influence on parliament, but they're not elected. They're the government's friends and the Queen's friends, and they become lords, and they cost the taxpayer a couple hundred million quid a year. They're allowed to claim £200 a day lunch expenses, yet this same government's talking about getting rid of free school meals for poor kids. You know, so you have all of these kind of built-in inequalities. And race is one of these many built-in inequalities. And it's not just race. Yeah. There are poor white communities in the UK who are very disenfranchised, who are very marginalised, who someone needs to talk to them and explain to them that it was always like this. It wasn't when the immigrants started coming here that it got bad. In fact, it was worse for you before the immigrants came here. The immigrants have done you a huge favour, like building the National Health Service. There was no National Health Service before Ghanaians and Jamaicans and Indian people came to England and built it. So it's very weird for working-class white people who, in many ways, were the main beneficiaries of a National Health Service, because rich people could always afford private care, to hate on the immigrants that built them a National Health Service, for example. But you have disenfranchisement on a number of reasons, and race is one of those. Yeah. And so the fear of giving too much power to too many people of colour in the UK, particularly if they've got the wrong political ideology, is very much there. So, for example, if Britain wants to invade somewhere in the Middle East, as it does very regularly, if you've got too many black and brown folks in government who respect themselves, naturally, they're going to be like, we don't want any more colonial wars. So Britain's not stupid. They know the implications of having real diversity. And real democracy is problematic, because real democracy means actually involving the people in decision-making, not just saying, well, we're the government, we're going to bomb Syria, or we're going to bomb Iraq, or we're going to do what we want. And so they avoid having real democracy by nepotism, by putting the right people in the right places, almost like a default prejudice. But it is changing, and there is like competing forces within the society. There are people that recognise it's problematic. There are people who are fighting against it who are not just black and brown folks. There is a sort of evolution of what British identity is. Until very recently, British identity was seen as a solely white identity. Mm. But now there are so many black and brown communities in the UK, and we're clearly not going anywhere unless, like, you can do expel 10 million people. You know, it's approaching that sort of number now when you add up all of the different immigrant populations. So it's a really fascinating time for the country, where the country's wrestling with, does it want to become more openly right-wing and bury its head in the sand and think that's going to solve the problems? Or is it going to embrace the reality that the old way of thinking is not going to work in the 21st century?
You talk about the days of your stepfather, your dad, being involved in fields of the arts, being involved in the community, being involved in community development programs, it appears. Do you recall or know of, or how important is the role of media in the hands of black and brown, as you say, and education? I mean, our only option here in this country is a colonial education.
Yeah.
There's one school here that I'm happen to be the president of. It's almost 30 years old, set up by members of my family. And it's for all people. It's not just for black and brown.
Mm.
But we own it.
Everyone needs an anti-colonial education.
We control it.
Yeah.
We determine what the policies and the and everything is.
So
but if you're a white fella
and you
live in the area, you're across the road, you want to come to school, you're welcome. You just come with respect and embrace what we stand for.
Yeah.
So education and media over there with people of colour.
So in Britain, in the late 80s, so in the UK, all through the 80s, there were uprisings in every Afro-Caribbean community and Asian community in Britain. I mean, literally half the country got burnt down. Every major city, London, Bristol, Manchester, everywhere where there's a black and brown population, usually because of police brutality, classism, race, so many different factors, and there were riots all up and down through the 80s. So at the end of the 80s, Britain started to change its policy a little bit and include black and brown folks in the country a little bit more. And this led to sort of a brief period where there was really good representation of black people, particularly in the media. There was a show called The Real McCoy. There was another show called Desmond's. These are like legendary shows that even today Black Britain looks back on and says, wow, that was the golden era. Because now we've sort of returned to a time where any show with a majority black cast is going to be about drug dealing and guns and murder and the same old kind of stereotypes.
Images, yeah.
With no, I mean, it's, I don't even mind that, but there's no police brutality in the same show. So we can show you black people brutalising each other, but police brutality is a rally for a lot of boys living in Hackney or elsewhere. So they did a show recently called Top Boy. $1 million an episode they gave for this show, and it was just, it was that same old thing. That's fine. That's part of reality. There are young boys in black neighbourhoods, in brown neighbourhoods, in poor neighbourhoods. That's part of the reality. The problem is when that's the only reality of that community that's ever been seen on national TV, it's like the only shows on TV about white people being about paedophiles. We've had loads of paedophile scandals in the UK.
This is nothing like that, is it?
Right. Yeah. Imagine constantly there were just shows about white paedophiles, day in, day out. Yeah. Everyone would be like, oh my God, I've seen a white guy, he's a paedophile. I need to check. So they have this thing called Stop and Search in the UK. Where they're like, oh, we need to stop and search more young black boys because they, you know, there's stabbings in those areas. I'm like, okay. That's the same logic as saying, you know, every time we see a white dude with a child, we should just check it's really his child in case he's a paedophile. Because we've had paedophile scandals, right? We're racialising a crime that doesn't occur only on grounds of race.
Yeah.
In fact, the most violent neighbourhood in Britain is East Glasgow. There's no black people there.
It's a white
it's a white neighbourhood. And it's violent. Like, it's crazy.
We have that similar here.
Drug addicts, madness. Like, it's mad. My family's all Scottish. I know about it.
But how does that... That actually feeds into your self-perception of yourself and your own people, doesn't it? Because you talk about that, how even black youth are...
We're racist.
...brainwashed into thinking, believing that.
In the Caribbean, there's a saying, and I've heard people say it. I've even heard my own grandmother say it. Anything too black can't good. Now, how can a black... My granny's jet black. How can someone say anything that's too black cannot be good and still have pride in themselves? They would refer to someone like me who's light-skinned as having high colour.
Yeah, right.
He's from a higher colour. Yeah, so the legacy of lighter skin being worshipped is very much still with us. You see it in rap videos, you see it in the culture, and that's still with us in the UK. And black people also are racist against black people. We have internalized the idea that black people are innately criminal, that are innately bad. You can't live in a society. You can't live in a society where the constant image of people that look like you is criminal, is bad, is horrible. Every time a black person does a crime, you emphasize their race. When a white person does a crime, he's just a bad individual. Same for the Muslim community. You start to internalize that. How do we know that? Because when I ask young African kids their names in England, this happens all the time, without fail. I go in school in Peckham, which is a heavily Nigerian and Ghanaian area. And I'll say to a kid, what's your name? And he'll laugh before he even says his name, because his name's not an Anglophile name.
Yeah, right.
So he's embarrassed by his African identity. When I go to Ghana and ask the same question, nobody laughs. They just give me their name.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? Because in Ghana, Ghanaian names are normal. There's no reason to laugh. It's not funny. It's not embarrassing. In fact, people are proud of their identity in Ghana or Nigeria. And so it's this internalization of the idea that you're inferior that is really almost like having proper schooling, education, better representation in media as part of overcoming that. But it's a challenge.
We got to decolonize our own mind. That's like a movement that's even starting
of course.
Here.
That's been,
But that brings us into the next topic I really wanted to talk about, because it really annoys me in Australia, just the number of youth who use the N-word everywhere. But even non-Aboriginal youth are now using the N-word as if it's a
Why?
Joke.
Why? What do you put that down to?
I was going to ask Akala that.
Well,
because you used to use the N-word in your raps, didn't you?
And then I stopped because a number of reasons. One, one of my elders spoke to me and was like, dude, what are you doing? You're better than that. Two, knowing a bit more history. But three, I started doing shows and I had, you know, 500 white kids screaming the word back at me. And
would
I realized
it be similar? Let me interrupt you a minute. Would it be similar to say then, well, what about bad language, offensive language? It'd be on the same level? I mean, dude, you're better than that. You don't need to express yourself.
Well, I don't really swear that much in my raps.
No, I don't know. It's just a question whether you do it or not. Would you sit it on the same in the
I wouldn't, because I think this word has so much more blood attached to it. Now, I realised that having young white kids shout it back at me made me very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That was one of the other reasons, which, you know, that I was like, I'm just not going to say this no more. Because no matter what I say, if I'm saying it all the time in my raps, people who support me are going to say it and think it's okay to say it. And it makes me uncomfortable. I don't mind, let me be clear, I don't mind people using the word. I mind people pretending it now doesn't mean anything and it's now a term of endearment. It's a tool of white supremacist genocide. Yeah. And if people are describing it in that way, I'm okay with that. But pretending it just means brother. The analogy I give people all the time.
That's the way people use it now, as if a joke.
But the analogy I give people is, would you call your grandmother that word?
Yeah.
And if you wouldn't, why not? If I said to you, you know, how's your N-word son? And you just had a brand new baby. Would you be a bit offended? And everyone asks that question. Like, yeah, I'd be a bit offended.
Yeah.
My mother's white, my dad's black. If I made songs, you know, racially derogatory towards white people, and white, glorifying white on white violence, which there has been masses of throughout history.
Mm.
25 million Russians died in World War II alone.
But
that's
you never see that in any.
That's white on white violence, right?
White on white violence. So it's not even a term.
If I start if I started glorifying it in that way, which I used to do with black people, what would people say? And every black boy asks this question, says to me, "No, that's racist."
Yeah.
So I'm saying, what are you saying? Then you're saying that black self-racism is okay, but me as a person who's of mixed heritage. Even though I identify as black, the point is obviously my mum's still white. Me doing that towards the white side of my heritage is offensive and racist. So for me, you know, I can't tell anyone else what to do. Artists are artists. I can't censor art. People are always going to do stuff that I don't like. But my personal analogy on the subject, especially like, I always say to when white kids are like, because at the Oxford talk, you know, a young white girl, after all that 2 hours of history, the best question
she could... So this is for our listeners. You did a like 2 hour lecture just off the top of your head about African history. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, so I did a lecture at Oxford Union. Yeah, so Carla Oxford Union address. And after all that, you know, information, which was really odd, one of the best questions the girl, a young lady, could come up with was about white people in the N-word. Basically, she wanted to say, why can't we use it? But she knew not to say that to me, yeah? And I was just like, well, what I want to know is why you want to use it. You know, as a young white person, knowing the history of the word, knowing the brutality that's behind it, knowing the legacies that black people are still dealing with, you're claiming you love hip-hop. I don't understand why you want to call your black friend that. I'm confused by that. My mum's white. She's never desired to be like, oh, yeah, my little N-word son, you know? It just is strange to me why you have this perverse fascination, almost like you feel like it's an impingement on your freedom, where people are like, you can't say it. Don't get me wrong, I don't think we should tell black Americans particularly have a different relationship to that word than everyone else.
That's right.
Right? If they want to use it amongst themselves, I'm not going to say it, tell them not to, but I'm going to say be aware of the consequences. And they need to figure out what they want to do. The rest of the world has sort of imitated black America's use of this word through hip-hop and comedy and whatever else without really being in quite the same place as black America. We've all experienced forms of anti-black racism, but America's unique. Brazil's unique. Australia's unique. The UK's unique. And I feel that copying of American culture, when it was the Black Panthers and Muhammad Ali and Malcolm, was very productive.
Yeah.
That copying of black American culture when it's, you know, coonery is probably not so productive. And so for me, it's something I just did away with. It's a word that was about turning an African person into a subhuman.
But this idea that you can actually even reclaim a term like that, I mean, it wasn't that long ago where there was, I don't want to say the word on air, but there was hunts of black fellas.
Yeah, of course.
You know, which were termed that.
Yeah.
So we have this bloody history in our own country. The idea that you can even begin to reclaim a term like that is really confusing.
But why would you
even
want to?
Yeah.
I mean, reclaim land, reclaim history,
yeah,
reclaim your sovereignty, reclaim your humanity. But I mean, to me, it's a symptom of our collective powerlessness as black people when we're like more concerned with reclaiming a word than we are with reclaiming land, history, sovereignty, political independence, things that are much more important. If we were in a position, because when brothers say to me, oh, it's about love, I'm like, okay, if young black men around the world spent most of our time loving each other, I could half agree with you. But we seem to be doing a pretty good job of murdering each other in England, in Jamaica, in Brazil, in America, in all the places where we're saying this word means love.
Yep.
I'm not denying that there's systemic reasons for that violence, but the point is we're not treating each other like brothers. So this word that when we go to kill someone, What is the word that you say? When I see that, I'm gonna do something to him, right? So it's clear that we're sounding like the Ku Klux Klan. We don't even realize it. Mm. So I don't agree that it has become a term of endearment. Yeah. Brother is a perfectly good term of endearment. Why would you need a better term than brother?
Yeah.
This is saying this is my blood relation, even if it's not. Why did we need to improve on that term? That's a great term. Or we use blood, which means like my blood, you know, or even cuz or fam.
Yeah.
These are all terms you could call your grandmother as a joke. She might give you a clip round the ear if she's like, what's up, fam?
Yeah.
But it means family, right?
Yeah.
It's not derogatory. So I just, at the best that can come of us trying to reclaim this word is we have one more word, wowee. The worst that can happen is that we're regurgitating and reinforcing our lack of humanity. And I think that's too big of a risk to play for me.
And you also mentioned before, I mean, you're talking about black American culture and just how influential it is across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this, I don't know, you wouldn't know this song, eh? It's a Kanye West and Jay-Z song about in Paris.
Yeah.
And that has that term has an interesting history, doesn't it, that bleeds into our perception of black people in the current day.
So there's a book called Medical Apartheid, which looks at the phenomenon of black people, African people going to Paris and bleaching their skin. And that's where that term N-words in Paris comes from. I'm sure Kanye and Jay-Z probably don't know that. But it's obviously an inherently colonial term. It's the idea that these dudes from the ghetto, black, downtrodden, we're now in the epitome of white wealth. This is great, Paris. Very racist city, a city in which the African population and the Arab population is pushed to the edges and treated very, very badly. And I always say to people, look, I'm not knocking them. They are what they are. But if I did a song called, I'd probably not have to say this on air, but H-word, the insult they use for white people in Harlem, which would actually be an interesting analogy of gentrification.
Yep.
You know, but I know that BBC Radio wouldn't play that. I know that mainstream radio wouldn't play that if I did that song.
The mainstream radio can play this song with a derogatory term.
Because black self-hatred is normal itself. Yeah. It's a commodity. Black self-love, people call that reverse racism, which is fascinating.
That's true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People are cool with us being entertained by us murdering each other in racialized terms. But we're like, oh, I love my people. I love black people. Oh, it's reverse racism. You can't do that. If you feel, intimidated by a group of people loving each other, you're a very strange person.
I mean, I guess, Tiger, you doing this radio show, because we got so many white listeners for the past 20 years. I mean, reverse racism, that argument must come up a lot, doesn't it? What would you say is the greatest response to someone who says it's reverse racism?
I think you should watch. There's an Australian comedian, brilliant comedian from Fear of a Blown Planet called Amir Rahman.
Yeah.
And he has a 3-minute YouTube clip called Reverse Racism. Just watch that, and that explains exactly what I'm saying. That is not to say that all people who are not white are wonderful, lovely, angelic human beings. Some of us are not very nice. Some of us are very horrible. Some of us are bigoted. But to argue that there is a systemic oppression of people on the grounds of them being white, I just want to know where. Show me where. Yeah. Where were the laws? Where was the systemic oppression? If it exists, I'm happy to say it exists. I just don't know where it is. I've studied history for quite a long time. I'm also mixed. So if the systemic oppression against white people exists, I should go to black countries and be oppressed on the grounds of being half white, right? The way that in a white country, I'm racialized as black.
Yeah.
When I go to Nigeria or Jamaica, I'm actually seen as, again, as I told you earlier, as higher class being half white. It doesn't matter that my white family is actually dirt poor. Yeah. They're peat farmers from the Outer Hebrides. The association with whiteness and wealth is still there. So that doesn't mean there are not individual acts of bigotry. That doesn't mean that some people don't assume that all white people are racist, even if someone might actually, really be an enlightened individual. There is that baggage, but there is no systemic discrimination on the grounds of whiteness in any country on the earth that I'm aware of.
No.
If it exists, I'd love someone to show me where, but I've not seen it yet.
We don't talk, you mentioned class quite a lot, and I think it's probably easier to see it in the UK, but we even when we talk about race issues, we don't talk about class much in this country. It's sort of this... Really, I guess we see ourselves as almost classless, but it's not really true.
In the UK, it's unavoidable.
Yeah.
I mean, the class system is so,
Well, again, clear. Because we're a very immature, a very young country, colonised only a few hundred years ago. But the class thing is starting to grow because we've seen a political development in this country from, say, long before the 60s, but I can only go back to the 60s where I recall. We started to establish our own organisations and putting things in place in the community to try to alleviate a lot of the problems. And from that, we sort of saw people get employed as CEOs, have some of our own mob get employed as CEOs and after 20 years.
Because you're talking more about the black middle class.
And
how is it a rising
this,
black
this sort of a class so thing sort of slowly is...
And the black,
but we don't really have this class, like you say, we don't really have that class.
Well, we don't talk
issue.
About it because I think we might. You know?
But it's very important. Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons Africa was colonised, or one of the things that allowed Africa to be colonised, was class.
Mm.
Certain
mm-hmm.
African elites, mm-hmm. and this is not exclusive to Africa, this is everywhere in the world. Elite groups, so British elites go somewhere, they find the local elite in India... Among the Native Americans, well, of course, that was Spanish and Portuguese who primarily colonized South and Central America, but they teamed up with local oppressors that already existed. So systems were not always perfect, And even today, if I go to Jamaica, there's a heavy class system. I go to Nigeria, disgraceful class system, where rich people consider themselves much better than poor people. Even among black America, we look at a lot of this class of educated, wealthy, elitist black Americans who look down on people from the ghetto. You know, even though the only reason they're even allowed to do in white people's toilets, literally, is because of the struggle of those people from the ghetto.
Mm.
Until 1965, you weren't allowed to do in white people's toilets. The only reason you're allowed to now is because of the struggle from the hood, right?
Well, that's the funny thing, because Tiger and all his, Dr. Gary Foley, Sol Belair, all the
Who
people at
the
Tent Embassy, they all fought for these rights that every citizenship rights that every other, citizen had. But it has led to this exactly what you're saying.
This middle class right now, like, oh, all you poor Aborigines who drink too much, who don't go to school, it's all your fault. Where those are the very people that fought for your rights.
So, blame the victim, yeah.
Yeah, so there is classism even among black and brown populations. We're not perfect angelic beings who are just all lovely to each other. So you get that privilege where it's like, I got money, I'm educated, why can't you just be like me?
I'm comfortable.
Exactly. And even though I came from, you know, poverty in the UK, obviously it's not third world poverty, but it's still, it's poorer than I think. When I travel to poor countries, I realise just how poor people in the UK are. They're a lot poorer than they realise. And they're a lot poorer than we want to take on. Like, 2 million people in the UK used food banks, donations of food last year, otherwise they would have starved. So you have this, you know, underclass that exists even in black and brown countries and that needs to be challenged. Because class oppression, once we defeat racism, there will still be class oppression and there'll still be gender oppression, you know, and those things are also things that need to be opposed because they're massive human problems.
Do you think we can defeat racism?
Yes, I think you can. It depends, right? Either the world is going to lose the power of the ideology of white superiority, or the world is going to end. There's no in between. No, I seriously mean it. Like America, the American Empire, even though there's multicultural people being used, the American Empire is an extension of white empire. The idea that China and India and Iran are going to occupy a seat back at the human table of power is offensive to the Anglo-American Euro Empire. The Euro Empire can either make peace with the fact that some yellow people and some brown people are going to have a seat at the table and share power, or they can destroy the world.
Yeah. Now, not going to do. Which one is it?
And we don't know. World War IV might come. You know, we'll skip right past World War III and go straight to IV. Now, if the world is not destroyed, then of course racism is going to collapse. Even for a country like Australia, how are you going to maintain a white supremacist identity when you're in the middle of Asia? Your leading trading partners in the 21st century are going to have to be China, India, Japan. There's no option for you to keep trading with America or Europe and pretend your economic survival is going to be dependent on countries that are not white. So naturally, the very meaning of what it is to be white, which is to be superior, that was how it was invented. This is obviously people who don't understand the history are going to think, oh, is he saying all white people are racist? All the European tribes of Europe became white as a way of saying we are better. Yeah, we're one unified family now, and that's a way of separating ourselves from people who are non-white.
So whiteness is almost synonymous with superiority.
No, of course it was. That's exactly why it was invented. So in a world where obviously whiteness does not confer superiority, for 150 years, the most developed civilizations in the world were all white. Mm. So the myth of white superiority could stay. Today, China's going to overtake America as the largest GDP on the earth by 2050. You know, blah, blah, blah. India's just sent a mission to Mars. It's very clear to anyone who's got a brain, white people are not special. We're all human and no one's really better than anyone else. And as that becomes clearer and clearer and clearer, I believe that the idea of what it means to be white will start to disintegrate and it will go back to how it was before. So the way that African and Arabs colonized Europe was one group of white people were having beef with another group of white people and they invited the Moors in as allies to colonize Europe. In 1526, the French were allies of the Ottomans against other Europeans. That got repeated 500 years later by the Germans who were allies of the Ottomans against other Europeans. So race is one dominant narrative. But when race no longer serves political objectives, when it no longer serves economic objectives, it will start to disintegrate. So as long as the world is not destroyed, I'm very confident that there'll be a rebirth of strong African, Asian, Latin American civilizations that will force racism to become this thing that we all, this horrible thing, this disgusting thing that killed millions of people, but we look back in history and think, wow, that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
How could anyone ever believe something so stupid that not having as much melanin made you superior?
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. I mean, yeah, I don't
even
know.
It's completely stupid.
I mean, I think humans are irrational as a whole point. We're completely irrational. So.
No, most certainly.
I think the racism in Australia is very different. It's about the unfinished business as well. It's about going back to the West because everything was predicated on stealing land and stolen land. So that's how this country was set up.
And at some point, there will have to be reparations. There will have to be an acknowledgement that wrong was done. There will have to be an acknowledgement that masses, unbelievable, astounding amounts of wealth were created from this wrong that was done.
Yep.
And that wealth needs to be shared. It's not just about money, because what people say when you talk about reparations. Oh, money, 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 money. No.
Yeah, reparations is only, compensation is one part of reparations.
Yeah. And compensation is absolutely a part of it. Let's be clear. I don't want to be one of these people who says money's not important. Money is important.
Yeah.
Right? But not even just money, resource is important. It's not about physical paper money. If someone's got land, they can make money. If someone's got resources, they can make money. If someone's got power and control and sovereignty, they can make decisions. So it's about a sharing of power. It's not about being nice and saying, oh, I'm sorry, that was really bad what happened, but I'm rich now and you're poor and that's just the way it goes. Yeah. It's about saying, you know what, this really bad thing happened and this is not controversial. Reparatory justice is a concept that exists and has been practiced
it's
for a very long time.
It's been made controversial, particularly in this country. Yeah, in the UK too.
So at the moment, there's the Caribbean islands are suing the governments of Europe for reparations for slavery and colonialism. And a lot of the mainstream politicians have said, this is ridiculous, blah, blah, blah. Mm. Interestingly, Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party, has had a very different feeling on it. He says, yes, actually, we made a tremendous amount of money out of the Caribbean, out of enslaving African people, which is common sense. And we can at least, at the very least, invest in those nations as equals, as partners, as a way of acknowledging the wrong that was done and the amount of wealth that was taken from it. And that should be done. The Caribbean was functionally kept underdeveloped as part of the deliberate legacy of
isn't European that colonial. Similar to now in Australia?
The Aboriginal community was kept functionally underdeveloped.
Yeah, it's totally, totally true.
So the sphere, obviously, and I get it, the fear is that if we give these people power, are they going to do to us the same things that we've done to them? And I get that fear, because that is a very real fear. And if people get power and I even do 10% of the bad stuff that Europe did over the last 500 years, that's a lot of bad stuff. And so I understand the fear too.
Yeah. Mm. Well, it's been really good to chat to you today, Carlo.
It's
the last day for me before the end of the holidays.
Oh, man.
So it was really good to have a really smart, intellectual guest in the studio today, and also to have Tiger back as well.
Thank you, sir.
No, thank you very much. That's really good.
And when do you go back to the UK?
Not till the middle of January. I'm going somewhere else from here. I'm going to do training camp in Thailand.
And you've actually just written a graphic novel, haven't you?
So I published, self-published two books. One is a book of poetry in 2010. One was a graphic novel called The Ruins of Empires in 2014, which is available on our website, akalamusic.com. Follow me on Twitter, at akalamusic. Show tonight in Brisbane at the Woolly Mammoth. Show tomorrow, Newtown Social in Sydney.
You must be exhausted by now.
A little bit.
But we really appreciate you coming in as well, don't we?
Yes, we certainly do, brother. Thank you very much.
Thank you, anytime.
We wish you well while you're on Aboriginal land. And safe travels, Amy.
No, thank you.
You all have a great weekend. Amy, you have a great break. And next time I see you, you'll be hopefully nursing a little one.
Yes, not long now.
Adding to our population.
Yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, you'll have a great weekend and a Merry Christmas.